It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
But, you know, hey, man, we know what's going on, so we just kind of stay out of the way and watch the ship of state just sink on its own. You know, everybody's so worried about we got to save the ship, save the ship. And it's got a big, giant, you know, iceberg gash in the side, and nobody even mentions the people. And I'm like, just screw the ship, man. You know, let's get the people off. Well, it's going down. There's a lot of reasons why, too, and how. And I tell you, war, this culture of war. We have been in the Afghan war longer than, I think, any other war. I mean, it's longer than Vietnam. I think Vietnam was longer, so what, we in the new world record of war? Yay. You know, and who do I want to talk to about this? I mean, who does radio every day on this issue? Scott Horton from antiwar.com/radio. And I got you there, Scott.
I'm here.
Scott, tell me what the big, you know, I got so much stuff here to go over with you, but I'm just, you know, tell me what the big news is, man.
Well, as far as Afghanistan or just the
everything. I mean, you're antiwar.com radio, man. I'm telling you, you guys are talking about the anti-war. Tell me what the big anti-war headlines are.
All right. Well, the top of the page today is high-profile Afghan failures worry Congress, and this worries me. I'm sure everybody saw the clip of St. Petraeus passing out at the Senate committee hearing yesterday, but what the news didn't emphasize was that right when he passed out was right when the part when Senator John McCain was saying, now look, can't have any artificial timetables for withdrawal here. We have got to stay until the job is done, until the fight is victorious and everything's great. And that was the part where our future dear leader, General Petraeus, couldn't take it anymore and actually lost consciousness there. They say it was because he didn't have breakfast, but I skip breakfast every morning. And they say it was because he didn't have water, but there was a big pitcher of ice water right there. It was the responsibility for overseeing this kind of catastrophe under the pressure of a hawk like John McCain saying we can't ever just say good enough and leave.
So what is John McCain looking for as the criteria for, you know, being done?
John McCain doesn't have criteria. The point is to just stay and fight forever for him. And
100-year war.
To ever leave would be to replicate Vietnam, right? To have that one loss on America's record that, you know, we're 20-1, it just ain't right, and we'll never live that one down, but we can certainly never repeat that mistake. And so rather than ever having a embassy situation where people are just fleeing, hanging onto the skids like the roof of the Saigon embassy there, we will just make sure that there's always enough firepower to be directed outward from our troops in that country that they'll never have to leave. They'll never win. Of course, it's a giant civil war between that's been going on for 30 years that America keeps switching which side we're on in it. But we're now back in the ones that fought for the Soviets. And when we leave, which we will eventually, because as you said, you know, the empire is going to fall apart regardless. The same reason the Soviet Union lost and left. It wasn't because they wanted to. It was because they just could not literally afford it anymore, no matter what. No more smoke and mirrors could prolong it. And when they left, their quislings and puppets and the communists, they got slaughtered. There was, you know, massive bloodshed. And the same thing's going to happen when we leave. And you'll hear the hawks from here on saying we can't leave because of the slaughter that will follow. But that's what happens when you prop up a minority in power that doesn't have natural power. in the country, the Pashtun there are the majority, and one way or another, they're going to be ruling Kabul in, over the long term. And, you know, somebody's got to take some responsibility at some point, Ernie, because basically all we're doing is putting off the inevitable there. We're not solving any problems for anyone. We're not saving the Afghan women. All we're doing is delaying the catastrophe, the worst catastrophe for everyone.
Maybe you can explain it to me better. Pashtun is what? I mean, it's an ethnic tribal group,
you know, right there on the Afghan-Pakistani border, and they're the majority of the people in the country, and they were the base of support. Not that it was really a grassroots of a thing. It was the Taliban were a Pakistani government creation originally, but the Taliban came from the madrasas from Afghan refugee camps inside Pakistan during the Russian War, and it was the Pakistanis who sent them in, but the Pashtun tribesmen were their natural constituency, or more or less natural constituency, and they ended up taking Kabul. And at the time of the American invasion in 2001, the Northern Alliance was virtually beaten, and then America intervened on their side, but the Civil War was just about over at that point. And of course, the leader of the Northern Alliance was suicide attacked by an al-Qaeda guy the day before 9/11. And to hear Eric Margulies tell it, this is the guy whose group we're backing now, he was one of the Mujahideen who pretended at least to fight the Russians and be on the side of the angels during the war of the 1980s. But it turns out he was KGB all along and was only pretending to fight. He was one of the primary recipients of American aid as well, and but was really just a KGB agent. And anyways, it's his group that we've installed in power in Kabul, and without a foreign empire like ours there to tip the balance of power, it is impossible that the coalition of Northern Alliance warlords who rule Kabul now would be able to, would have ever been able to, or certainly in this era, or would be able to hold it once we leave. For example, the current Secretary of Defense, or whatever they call him over there, the war minister under Hamid Karzai, our puppet, is a guy named Dostum, General Dostum, who is responsible for the Afghan massacre in the fall of 2001, where they suffocated more than 1,000 prisoners in, tractor-trailer beds, basically, like big storage containers, and machine-gunned them all to death and suffocated them in there. And is one of the most throat-slitinist, skin-you-alive, mass rapist, murderer warlords in that whole society. And this is a guy that America is propping up in power. He's their Don Rumsfeld over there right now under Hamid Karzai's regime. And so this is, you know, obviously a completely untenable situation, trying to install a government that could never last in a country that never had a single
central government
that lasted ever.
That's yeah, this whole thing is about the Afghan government. That's one thing I want to get to. And I keep asking guests that come on, you know, a lot of these NGO guys that this week I've had probably three or four people that actually went over and spent time with the Afghans and the Pakistanis and the camps. And all they want to do is just get more government tax money to go away from the war and just go to them because, we broke it. Now we got to fix it. And they want to steal from me some more. And I'm going, look, just stop stealing. Let's just leave. I just want to leave. But I did want to get an understanding of the border situation there that I don't think they go that deep. And maybe you can help me out here. You go to Pakistan on the border with Afghanistan, and there's like an imaginary line there. Mm-hmm. And it's really, you know, was put there by whom? I mean,
exactly imaginary. It's called the Durand Line, and it was drawn by the British in their typical divide-and-conquer strategy to try to keep the Pakistani Pashtuns separate from the Afghan Pashtuns and what have you. But it's, as you say, it is imaginary. It is much less of a border than the Rio Grande, for example, which you can actually look at and is, you know, somewhat real. Maybe the Mexican border is a better example more and more these days, where it becomes
less
meaningful. In parts of the American Southwest, not that I care, but anyway. Yes, it is. I mean, like all borders are imaginary of these fictional states with their monopoly claims on the right to initiate crimes against people. But this is one particularly ridiculous Western-imposed border between Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Well, we have this situation, like, for a lot of people to understand and put it kind of a, you know, in another area, you have Iraq that's on the border with Turkey, and that incorporates both part of Turkey and Iraq is the, Kurdistan, the Kurds. And Kurdistan is, and that was another imaginary line put up there, you know, after the Ottoman Empire fell after World War One, and you got the British and the French and carving up Saudi Arabia, and it's our oil now. This guy just signed a contract that we put in place to be able to sign the contract that said it's ours. And the same thing is going in Afghanistan. Of course, they have to have a national government, so they got somebody to sign the contracts, you know? So I'm just, when we get back, you know, we're going into break, but when we get back, you see, Scott's the man. When it comes down to, I need to have you on beginning of the week, because dang it, man, I need an edumacation. And I look at a map and it don't tell me nothing. What I really need to know is the cultures, the ethnicities, the religions, the people that are really going to make the difference, and who's interfering and why. We're going to find out from Scott Horton from antiwar.com/radio.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Yeah, let's take a break. Let's just stop here for a little bit on Declare Your Independence. Me, Ernest Hancock, and look around with our good friend Scott Horton from antiwar.com/radio. Because, you know, Scott, he lives and breathes this every day. And as much as we are occupied with this, certainly on freedomsphoenix.com and on this show, you know, I don't do near the work that Scott does. And besides, I always rip you off on antiwar.com for my stuff anyway. So, you know, what I want to do is ask you this one thing, Scott.
Sure.
I need to know what the real, if you can break down to me what the ethnicities are, the tribes, how many, are there a few, are there hundreds, are there thousands, are there, you know, what's really going on here? Because they keep trying to consolidate Afghan into one, you know, like we got a constitution and contract and they signed, and oh, by the way, they got eminent domain on your minerals underneath your thing, and it's ours now. I mean, that's what they want. They want to be able to take somebody that's been goat herding on in a valley there for generations and generations and hundreds of years and saying, oh, man, didn't you get the memo? It's ours now. How are they able to do that? And but first, I want to, before we get into that, you know, I'm going to let you ramble, but I want to know, what are the ethnicities and religions and so on? How many are there and where are they dispersed? I'm looking at a map now. Help me out.
All right. Well, I'm the furthest thing from a real expert on this. You should talk with Eric Margolies, really. But the Pashtuns basically are the majority by, I think, about 60%, and they mostly inhabit, that's a ethnicity, a tribe. I don't know if it's quite a nationality or what. I don't, you know, I'm an individualist and I don't really believe in these things. I have to kind of force myself to accept these categorizations of people. But so, you know, the border kind of bends down and to the left there. And all along that border region is basically the Pashtuns up into the federally administered tribal areas, into the Hindu Kush Mountains, and down toward the Iranian border. And then to the north and the west from there, you get to Uzbeks, Tajiks, Hazaras, and a few other minor groups. Minor in number. But you hit the real key there, which is that, first of all, this is not a nation state. This is a British-drawn border. If there ever was really a central government, it was a puppet kingdom that didn't last very long anyway. And going back to Alexander the Great and Genghis Khan, people, you know, the Golden Horde literally could not conquer this land. Genghis Khan, his group, Alexander the Great, could not. The Soviet Union, the British, have all failed at attempting to take over this land. And, you know, as you correctly, you know, describe the situation, it's a question of property rights. It's a question of who does the land belong to, whether it's individuals or tribal groups or whatever. clearly, you know, whoever they are, if they consider themselves some collective tribe and they say this is our valley, and as you said, they've been there for generations and centuries and what have you, it's theirs. That's what John Locke says. You take land, you mix your labor with it, nobody else interferes or has a competing claim, it belongs to you. That's where property rights come from. And that's, you know, the basis of our civilization. So this is about not respecting them. This is about saying, you know, our puppet dictator in Kabul, the mayor of Kabul, as people used to mock Karzai as being, he signed a piece of paper that says that we can take whatever we want out from your valley, just as you described it, eminent domain.
The one thing I wanted to point out is, you know, I think it was Ayn Rand probably was one that I remember the most that articulated this most recently was, you know, let me tell you what your property right is. Your property right is what you can keep, you know, and Afghanis, you know, they have been keeping it for thousands of years. So they go, guess what? It's ours. You know, I mean, how many times do we got to, you know, fend off and kill empires before you start to realize it ain't yours?
Right. So, well, and the whole thing is, too, is who in their right mind could even imagine that, you know, dozens of years and millions of troops later, you would have an advanced industry in Afghanistan that's getting ore out of the ground and turning it into useful things and transporting it to the port of Karachi and to your local, you know, Radio Shack shelf. It just isn't going to happen. It's not going to happen. So who do we need to control these resources to prevent from getting them? Because after all, you saw the New York Times article. Oh, look, there's lithium in them Thar Hills. We'll go in there and, hey, guess what? Now the war is about stealing lithium, everybody. We can all get on board for that, right? Need those for our cell phones, and we're all expected to get on board for that. But, of course, even if it was possible to develop those resources and those markets and get that stuff out to market, it doesn't matter who is doing the developing, what company or which country's company is doing the developing of those resources. It's a world market in these minerals. The only question, Ernie, is who's the middleman? Which company? It's not about whether you can get the right parts for your cell phone at your local you know, Sprint outlet or whatever. The market will get you what you need for your cell phone. The question is which group of private criminals, corporations, get to make all the margin? Iraq, all the oil is going to get to market no matter what, but is it going to be Exxon that's getting it to market, or is it going to be some French company that's getting it to market, some Chinese or Russian company that's getting it to market?
Well, that's one thing that I want to.
It's going to be them, not us, because we lost the Iraq War.
No, this is one thing that I want to bring up. You have, if you look at the map, and those of you listening on the radio, let me try and give you an idea of how it plays in the Middle East, okay? I'm looking at a map here, and I have Africa. I got Egypt, the Sudan, Ethiopia, you know, the west side of the Red Sea. On the other side of the Red Sea, you have Saudi Arabia. At the bottom part, you got Yemen, you got Oman, United Arab Emirates as you're going around in the Persian Gulf up to Iraq. Now, Iraq is on the top of Saudi Arabia. To the west of Iraq is Syria, Jordan, and then you got Israel, and then you got a little, you know, thing, Lebanon. Turkey is north of Syria and Iraq, and it borders the bottom half of Turkey. Half of it's on the Mediterranean. The other half to the east has Syria underneath it and Iraq. And then there is a good-sized border that goes up to the east side of Turkey that is Iran. Now, Iran separates between Afghanistan and Iraq. So Iran is a totally different culture than the Arab. They're Persian. They're just not even in the same category, you know? And just like Afghanistan has different ethnicities also. Well, Afghanistan, surrounding it, you have, you know, to the left, you know, to the west, you have Iran. Then you go Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, you have Tajikistan, Wardistan, Thisistan, whatever. To the bottom, you got Pakistan, and then below Pakistan is India. Now, this is one thing that's different about Afghanistan. It doesn't have a seaport, okay? If you're going to go to the ocean, you got to go through one of these other countries. You know, usually the ones that they're border with is Iran and Pakistan. Now, Karachi is where they probably the most popular port, you know, coming out of Pakistan. Now, what's interesting here is this little sliver of Afghanistan that goes, it's like a little isthmus almost, that goes over and connects and borders China. China shares, it looks like it shares a border with Afghanistan. Is that true?
That's right. Just a tiny little one.
I mean, little bitty baby border here. Now, what has China, the communist evil empire of China, what have they taught us? It's a lot cheaper to just do this capitalism thing and just go buy it. Go do contracts with the locals, to go to Africa, and we'll just negotiate. We don't need, you know, a military. We'll just go up and say, hey, man, who do we got to, you know, pay off here? You know, that's what it comes down to. They're just going to pay off whatever. And that's how the U.S., this imperial concept, is that we're going to install a government that has, you know, a piece of paper that says we rule you, and then we're just going to go ahead and take your stuff or force you into compliance, where China is willing to just go pay for it. And I'm going, which one's cheaper? It's not about being cheaper. It's about who gets the deal. Well, China's a little different because the whole country's the deal. I mean, they're the company. But here in imperialist America, what we got to do? We got to go have the military go do the work of Halliburton, Exxon, and whoever else. Oh, it's not going to work.
There are those that just want to be left alone, and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
I bet you it's not Scott neither.
No, probably not.
You know, so this is, you know, I think of you. You gotta get, every time I have Scott, I mean, all the 60s anti-war songs just come to mind.
I'm,
you know,
not a hippie. I play hardcore on my show.
No, I understand. I understand. You know, Scott's a hardcore, no compromise, libertarian, anarchist kind of man. I don't need the man telling me anything other than, if you're not there to protect individual rights, what the heck are you here for? You know, I get it, man. But, you know, the one thing that I did want to get into is on China's role in this. China just bypassing Afghanistan, or are they going to start bidding up the war here?
Well, I think they're already walking around with briefcases and handshakes and trying to do business, which I think has the American empire in a panic. You know, please forgive me for this, Ernie, but I got to give a shout out to Vladimir Lenin here. Lenin said that imperialism is the highest form of capitalism. Now, I know that you're a good libertarian anarchist, and you know that capitalism as economic system does not necessarily depend on the establishment of any state whatsoever. But of course, as Marx meant the term, well, he basically meant the term the way that you and I, what we call mercantilism or corporatism, that of course it's going to be all about the state power being used on behalf of the people who already have the most in the private interest sector, you know? And so, of course, what they do is just what you were saying on the way out to break there. They can spend $1 million lobbying a congressman to spend $1 trillion on a war to make $1 billion off of it. And it's an equation for suicide. I mean, this is national suicide. This is why all empires fall, because their capital just becomes an imperial court, and everyone is so corrupt, they all lie, even to each other. Nobody knows exactly what's going on other than that. They're there to get theirs. And literally, you can buy off a congressman or a senator for chump change, take them out for steak dinners and wine and dine them, and then you got the contract. You get to reach your hand right into the biggest honeypot in the history of mankind, the U.S. Pentagon's budget. And this is the name of our disease. This is what's killing the society, Ernie. It's the same reason that we got drones in our local sheriff's departments now. It's the same reason we got armored personnel carriers and M4 machine guns and whatever else. It's a financial game from
people who can afford
to invest in a congressman.
No, I'm hip, you know, and you phrase it even better than I do, but I understand the concept. You know, one thing that I did look at when, I remember when oil hit $60-$70 the first time in, probably was it 2005, I think, or six, and it was just getting stupid. And what happened was I go, you know, how much does oil really cost? I mean, I'm not seeing the benefit of us going, you know, we got to get $70 oil down to $30 oil. oil, so we just go over and take over all the oil in Iraq, and then we'll have a bunch of oil. And like, you know, Wolfowitz's thing is like, yeah, we're going to have this war, we're going to make money, you know? So I'm going, okay, well, let's, you know, let's factor it in. Okay, how much is the cost of us going over there? Well, the military and all the wounded and dead and the Veterans Administration and the interest and on and on and on. And just from rough sketching it out, it came to like $137 a barrel above the oil.
Absolutely.
To go get cheap oil. And I'm going,
yeah, David Henderson did a great study for the Cato Institute years ago where he said, look, we're spending more than what we pay for oil per year from the Middle East on military domination of the Middle East. This is insane. It doesn't matter who's in charge over there. They're going to sell it on the oil market. It's a world market, and it's literally illiquid. It's as fungible as a commodity on the world market could possibly be. And in fact, the former CIA analyst Michael Scheuer, the former chief of the Bin Laden unit, quoted Bin Laden himself as saying, you know, if in a million years and George Bush's, you know, worst lie come true, he was somehow the dictator of Saudi Arabia himself. He said, what are we going to do? Drink it? It's for sale. We just are tired of playing this game where we set the price wherever Houston wants it, too high or too low, depending on, you know, who they're trying to take out of the marketplace.
Yeah, no. I have complete understanding. It is very simple. It's called math. And
yeah.
The math is going to put it in such a, because you bring
math
up a good
even
point.
Even I can do, Ernie.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is, and to understand that you can put embargoes on this stuff and you can boycott and you can do all kinds of things that you want. But, you know, Venezuela is going to sell their oil somewhere. You know, somebody's going to buy it. And if they buy it and use it somewhere else, that just makes more oil available that they didn't use somewhere else than we buy. I mean, what's the difference?
The worst part of this is that, you know, this whole economic theory of mercantilism that we're operating under here was debunked by Adam Smith in 1776 in The Wealth of Nations. That's the whole point of the book. Is we don't have to invade France and occupy their orchards to drink their wine. You know?
Well, the role that China's playing in this is, I think we could probably equate it to what they're doing in Africa. Because it was only in the past year or so they created AfricaCon, you know, from the military's got now their own little, I was kind of surprised they didn't have one already, to be honest.
Well, and then, they've been working on the United States of Africa in one form or another for a while, but it's going to be a while still, I think.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to have the same luck they've had in the Middle East. I mean, you know what? There's not enough ethnicities there. You know, so enough tribal war going on. They got enough problems there from the imaginary lines they did back in the day there.
Absolutely.
You know, this is all these lines are just from, you know, broken empires from before, from the French and the Portuguese and the English. And all this is going to, if you look at a map of the world now, compared to even just last century, beginning of last century, I mean, it's a lot different, you know. So this is going to, you know, all we got to do is look at Bosnia, you know. So I can see, you know, Yugoslavia. I mean, heck, the kids now, you know, Yugoslavia, what's that? I mean, they have no concept of what it was. So I'm looking at Afghanistan. We're focusing on Afghanistan now, and I'm wondering what the role of Iran is in this. We have bases in Afghanistan and Iraq and Saudi Arabia and Turkey and even some of the, you know, Uber stands or whatever, all the stands in there, you know, from the former Soviet Union, we even got Air Force bases and such. And we've surrounded Iran, and Iran is going to, I don't think they're going to go quietly into that good night. And then we're like, have this attitude they're not allowed to duck. I mean, you know, let me ask you this. This is a good point. I'm going, they always say, we cannot allow Iran to get a nuclear weapon. And I'm going, why not? You know, if I'm Iran, I'm going, the only reason I wouldn't get one is because I think it would be probably a bad, you know, PR thing. I mean, you don't going to give the bad guys an excuse to come blow you up. But I'm going, you know, philosophically, they're not allowed to defend themselves against a bully that's beating the living crap out of everybody around them.
Well, there's two answers to it. And, they're both Israel. The first answer is that Israel will not tolerate or does not wish to be in a situation, no matter what, where they are deprived of their nuclear monopoly in the Middle East. Right now, they're untouchable. Right now, we all know that any crocodile tears about destroying Israel and all the Israelis being pushed into the sea and whatever, so much hyperbole, because we know they got 600 nukes, including H-bombs. We know that no Arab country is a threat to them or could ever be. Certainly not if it came all the way down to the destruction of the state. We know that they would use their nukes and that they would therefore win with those nukes, although it could be pretty self-destructive. But their entire policy is hinged upon being able to say to the rest of the region, what? Yeah, that's what I thought, and keep everyone intimidated that no one has the ability to even attempt to strike at them. And then the second thing is, I think, and there have been plenty of reports to this effect in the Israeli press, the Israeli government knows that the Iranians, even if they did, I don't know, because they're certainly not making their nukes, Ernie, and I can tell you all about that if you want, but even if the Russians just gave them 20 or something, they still, they're not, there's no reason to believe, there's no reason for the Israelis to believe, and they have said this themselves, the government there has said, there's no real reason to believe that they would strike Israel with nuclear weapons. They know Israel has nukes, too, and would shoot back. It would be a mutually assured destruction situation, which, you know, history tends to show so far, at least. Gulp means no nuclear war. But what it would mean is a immediate decrease in the number of Jews around the world going to Israel, making Aliyah and moving to Israel. And it might even scare many into going home to whichever countries they used to live in, like the United States of America, for example.
Oh, you think that's the motivation, is that if Iran has nuclear weapons, that Israel would lose a lot of Jewish people coming to the homeland? Is that what you're saying?
I think that's a major part of the problem that they're looking at.
Well, see, that's the one thing that I remember it was...
No. The question now is, for me, what does that have to do with America? Why would America have a policy about Iran's nuclear weapons just because Israel doesn't want them to have any?
No,
I'm
with you, brother. I'm with you. You know, I say it on the show a lot. Am I allowed not to care? Certainly not enough that they're just taking my money and redistributing it to anybody. I mean, I don't want them ripping me off to give money to Montana, much less outside the border. So, you know, we got plenty to talk about in the last segment in just a little bit.
Rhodes, it's the Ernest Hancock Show. Where we're going, there aren't any roads.
Out the wall! Now, good God, hear me sing. Don't put it off another day. Everybody sing. Stop the war. Nah, 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 nah. Don't put it off another day. Why can't we just can't be so tough?
Woo! Yeah! Man, I'm going to try to hit the high note here on Declare Your Independence of me, Ernest Hancock, and Scott Horton from antiwar.com/radio. Radio Antiwar with Scott Horton. You know, Scott, I wanted to make sure that we, you know, had this. You know, we need to have you back more, man. I mean, are you going to be available for me? Come on, do me a solid.
Yeah, anytime.
You know, this is, because this is, I talk to so many people, and, you know, I'd like to get Eric Margolis on, but he's so hard to get. Let him know that I'll try to get hold of him, okay? Because I'd love to have him on. I mean, we've had him on before, and I'd love to get him on, but he's so busy. And the thing that I really want to understand is, what is the future? You know,
I think ask your buddy Charles Goyette, and he'll tell you the dollar's going to break, and then the soldiers are going to have to hitchhike home, I guess, because the government isn't going to have any money to pay him. And it's going to be the end of the empire, and if we're lucky, it's going to look like the fall of the Soviet Union, which was absolutely horrible. I think we'll actually be a lot better off than that, because we actually at least have the remnants of the infrastructure left over of advanced market capitalism in this country, and we have an incredible amount of engineering skill intellectual capital beyond measure. So I think we can survive it, but, you know, I'm a Ron Paulian on this question always. You know, you look at what we're doing, falling exactly on the path of the most criminal and, in fact, dumbest empires in history, who just hurtle themselves off a cliff. And when it's this apparent to us all, you know, it seems like the obvious thing to do would just be to say no. Just stop this right now. First thing is first, just abolish the Pentagon. We don't need them. We'll keep an army of, you know, 75,000 men and a couple of good submarines to defend our coast, and we'll be fine. No more empire. Just call it off and start shoring up what we need, what we know we need to shore up here, such as our Bill of Rights, for starters, and then, you know, the right of a man to go about his business and make some money. without you know, being punitively taxed into wanting to not even try anymore. You know, peace and freedom. And in fact, you know, as long as I'm on this rant, let me go ahead and say, too, how badly we need anti-demagogues like you, Ernie, for example, and like Charles Goyette and like Ron Paul, who preach that what we need to get back to is peace and freedom, when it's so easy for a Sarah Palin or a Glenn Beck to say, well, we just need to get back to, but what they want to get back to is a bunch of evil, hateful, right-wing, reactionary nonsense. Like, we need to get back to persecuting the poor and Spanish-speaking. We need to get back to persecuting gay people so they just kill themselves in the closet when they're little kids or teenagers so we don't have to deal with them later. Or, you know, you see it all the time. The
demagoguing against
the weak.
No.
And what we need is demagoguing, if anything, against the powerful. But most importantly, what we need is anti-demagogues who can simply preach. We don't need to get back to, you know, a white Christian nation. We don't need to get back to anything that's going to have to be at the expense of any of the rest of us. We need to get back to simply just peace, the Bill of Rights, sound money, et cetera, like Ron Paul says, and we'll be just fine. We have nothing to fear but fear itself and our own stupid policies.
Now, let me. You brought it up, so now we got to talk about it. You know, the Glenn Beck, Sarah Palin kind of thing, you know, I mean, you know, we could spend a whole story on, you know, a show on this Rand Paul Tea Party. Man, I don't even want to get into that right now, too late. But we'll talk about that another time. But I tell you one thing I did want to get your perspective on. The Tea Party movement, I mean, of course, we knew where it came from. You know, it was more a Ron Paul thing, and then they kind of Fox News and Clear Channel went and got the permits for the stage and a microphone and said, look, all these people here, they want whatever we tell you they want. And I'm looking at this, and you see this Glenn Beck and the Sarah Palin, and they come out, and they're like, you know, we're mad as heck, and we're not going to take it anymore, and we want, how do you think that's going to play out? I mean, who are they?
I think we have a real opportunity to lead them here. I'm sure you probably saw Ron Paul and Sarah Palin on Judge Napolitano's show,
yep.
And she
yep.
can't help but lean toward Ron and toward the judge, because they're just too right about everything, and she doesn't have the grounding in her, you know, evil positions to really stick to them too hard.
You know,
and
this
I noted
is what she
that,
said.
I saw an email alert went out earlier that now Jacob Hornberger, who is as plumb-line libertarian as a minarchist can be, and is as radical as you or me, and is 100% on every single issue, is going to be a guest on the Glenn Beck show. And, you know, when the right's out of power, we have an opportunity to try to get them to see about how real liberty works, Ernie, and when they're in power, we know how it is.
When's Bumper going
to
be on?
I'll get tortured to death.
When's Bumper going to be on?
Oh, I don't know, but sometime soon, maybe tonight, tomorrow, something like that. It was in the email earlier. But the point is that, you know, the good part about the bad part of the Tea Party movement is that they don't know what the hell they're talking about, being for torture and mass murder and empire on a global scale and drug wars and every bit of this is madness. You don't even have to be a libertarian. All you got to do is be a regular, reasonable person. See, every bit of this is madness, and we're at the end of our rope anyway. So what's it going to be? You want to give up your grandma's Social Security, or you want to give up the Pentagon? These are your choices. You don't get to say, we just want to keep printing money forever and ever and ever, because that's not going to work.
You know, this is one thing that I saw out of Sarah Palin. You know, they had the, you know, we posted it up on Freedom's Phoenix, of course, and we watched Sarah Palin and Judge Napolitano and Ron Paul going at it. And I tell you, I'm really impressed with Napolitano, man. He's pretty hardcore. And I was at the Liberty Forum in New Hampshire, and he got up there, and, man, he just railed against Lincoln. What a scumbag he was. And he went on about, you know, he eliminated habeas corpus. He did the draft. He invaded the South. He did all this kind of. So you got a lot of older people sitting there going, whoa, what the heck was that?
Well, and he said the same things about George Bush on Fox News for 8 years straight. And I don't know, you know, if he's just, you know, golfing buddies with the directors there or whatever, that they couldn't bring themselves to get rid of him. But he opposed the Patriot Act all along. He opposed torture and rendition and prison without trial and the unitary executive theory and the plenary, unlimited powers of the commander-in-chief to do anything he wants and violate any law. And Judge Napolitano was great on that this whole time. He's no Johnny-come-lately. He's an original Ron Paul OG.
Well, you know what I'm thinking is that Murdoch either sees he's just planting, you know, seeds or want to have ace up a sleeve in case this whole planet goes libertarian. And he needs somebody to lead the way, you know, and make some money at it. But yeah. So, you know, I'm not really sure the dynamic there. I'm glad to see it happen. And this show with Palin was the first time I think he was on, you know, Freedom Watch's Fox Online, which it had such an enormous audience online. Heck, it eclipsed some of their on-air hosts on the network. So
it was a very carefully phrased set up thing where he didn't put her in direct competition with Ron on the argument too much because it just wouldn't be fair. You know, it really wouldn't be fair.
Well, the one point that I want to get to before...
speaking, but he got her to say, no, we can't just spend on an uninhibited empire, which that's pretty good for Sarah Palin. Backing down from, yes, benevolent global hegemony, like Bill Kristol told me to say, forever and ever and ever. That's pretty good. And he got her to back down a little bit on the war on pot, too. And she said, well, it was contradictory and kind of nonsensical. She said we shouldn't legalize it, but we shouldn't enforce it either. And the cops should go and try to solve real crimes instead of kicking in people's doors over weed. So, you know, this is how easy it is to get even, you know, she's a pretty bad demagogue on some pretty bad issues. But then again, she knows she doesn't know what she's talking about either. So when she hears the straight dope from Ron or from Judge Napolitano or whoever, I think that she can be led, you know?
You know, I think she has been. Yeah, I think she has been led. That's how she got there. You know, the one thing that I did notice, and I want to get this in, is that towards the end, she saw that it was her job to say this one thing, man. She was sitting there waiting for this one thing to get out. And that was, yeah, but the libertarians, you know, they don't believe in the use of government to do the good stuff. You know, that we don't have government there. The libertarians would, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater, and we need the government to fill in the blank, you know, socially and economically engineer on certain things. And she had to say it. And I'm just going, you know, I'm sure she said that. That was part of what her rhetoric had to be on this show, to say something negative about libertarians. They're going too far on, you know, this freedom thing where they would actually see the government as a detriment to blah, blah, blah.
All that means is the war party's on the defensive now.
Yep.
And, you know, this is the greatest thing. And you and I think we discussed this, you know, 2 years ago or whatever. We saw this coming, that Ron Paul is the only intellectual leadership that the right has. I mean, look at who their Senate minority leader is. Their highest-ranking Republican is Mitch McConnell, who looks like a vile pedophile, who's a horrible warmonger, who makes no sense, has no ideology, he's simply a front man for whatever corrupt interests put him there. And that's all they got. And then they got Rush Limbaugh, and they got Dick Cheney's daughter. And then we got Ron Paul, who makes Thomas Jefferson look like James Madison. So how do they compare to that? He just comes out and goes, no. See, regulations is what lets BP get away with blue bloody murder. Free markets is how to actually hold them accountable. And everybody goes, huh. And then he goes, yeah, see, when you print money, it creates big bubbles. And then you got to suffer the big splash, the recession, and then your rising prices and the destruction of your savings. And people go, oh, yeah. And then he goes, yeah, and you know, when you go around killing people around the world, sometimes they get mad and they want to kill you back. And then that becomes the excuse for your next one, and we really need to knock this off. And they go, wow, that old man really makes a lot of sense. And who else on the right has anything to say at all to that? David Frum? I mean, come on. We ought to have already won, Ernie.
No, you make good points. It's been a pleasure having you on, Scott.
Thank you,
man.
Ernie. I appreciate you having me.
I want you to come back. We'll schedule something out. There's so many other things. It's so refreshing to have a conversation with someone that just understands the future, what's going to happen. It's math. It's inevitable. This is just a chronology of history repeating itself again. That's why they call it revolution. It keeps coming around. And for the same reasons. Scott Horton, antiwar.com/radio, and you'll get more, Scott, and you need more. We'll see you tomorrow afternoon on the radio.